Amnesty International is the world's largest human rights organization with over 10 million contributors across 150 countries. I interviewed the global CIO, Paul Smith, and what a privilege it was. We unpacked Paul's career from a wannabe pilot from a humble working class family in the Midlands, right through to him joining Amnesty International as global CIO earlier this year. Paul actually speaks candidly about how the cost of university was a bridge too far. We also discuss the challenges of balancing a large family, he's got six children, with the high pressure of working in the leadership team of a world-renowned organization. We also take a global macro view and step outside of the bubble of the Western media machine, and Paul gives us his thoughts on the current global situation outside of what is reported in the UK. Paul strikes me as a very understated and quietly confident individual and leader. Some compelling anecdotes and you know, a brilliant conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's Paul Smith. So, Paul, thank you for coming on the Tech Leaders Podcast.
Thanks, Gareth. Appreciate you having me.
No problem. I've been looking forward to this. Amnesty International is an organization that I've always looked up to and revered, if I'm honest, for some of the amazing work that the organization carries out, and its rich history is something to behold, and a bit of a national treasure, I think, isn't it? You know, people don't talk about Amnesty International in those terms, but it's a British institution, headquartered in the UK, though, may I add?
Yeah, headquartered in the UK, you're right. But we are global, and you know, we've been trying to make a difference for human rights good for 60 years, which is a hell of a mission and very commendable. So they certainly don't need any introduction, and they certainly didn't need an introduction to me when I applied to join them.
Absolutely. And you must have been very proud when you secured that role. But I wanted to rewind back then, Paul. Let's go back to the beginning, okay? Because you didn't come from a conventional background, really, for a CTO, did you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think there are many CIOs that kind of land straight in tech these days. But I guess starting from the very beginning, I guess, you know, I grew up in a council estate in the Black Country in the Midlands. You know, so I'm a Dudley boy. I grew up wanting to be a pilot, an Air Force pilot, RAF pilot. But I'd always worked as long as I can remember. My father was a mechanic. So, you know, I was the kid on the driveway holding the torch, passing the spanners. And then that turned into workshop jobs at weekends, you know, as a workshop's mate, as a, you know, a cleaner. And then as I got into a teenager, as a valeter, I worked on cars and I did a few bits and pieces. So I've always worked as long as I can remember. And as I went through school, never studied IT in school, never studied IT in college. In fact, I went the science route. I did a VTEC in science. But life hit me at 19 and I had my first little girl. And it changed my priorities completely. And at that point, it was, well, what do you want to do, Paul? And I spent a bit of time as a computer-aided designer working in electronics. I spent a bit of time in engineering as a CNC engineer. And I'm using that term grandiosely. I really wasn't a qualified engineer, but I tried my best. I sat down one night and decided I needed to do something. And I'd always been interested in computers, you know. I was always a gamer. I had this, you know, Sinclair Spectrum and the Nintendo.
Hey.
I was the kid in the bedroom, you know, pressing play on the tape and waiting for the tape to load. And I thought, well, can I turn an interest into a job? And at that point, I looked at what part-time courses were around at uni, and there were a couple of HNC options at that stage, and one was engineering and one was computing. And I'd done engineering, didn't fancy that, so I thought, well, let's give this computing thing a shot. Working 6 days a week and doing uni on my seventh day on a Thursday for a couple of years got me a HNC in computing, and I got my first IT job off the back of that.
Brilliant. Okay, so you got into the IT space, you got an opportunity, you went, did an HND, you got an opportunity. Tell us a little bit about that. You worked for a company called G3 Systems.
That's right, yeah. So I started, well, I cut my teeth in IT in the defence space. So G3 were a prime defence contractor for the UK MOD.
Yeah.
And they worked in various areas, actually, but predominantly in equipment and systems and logistics. So lots of engineering type stuff, but overseas. That job was fantastic. I learned so much. I grew so much, not only as an IT professional. I mean, they invested heavily in me, but they also sent me around the world. You know, I spent time in Afghanistan. I've been to Kandahar Airfield and Camp Bastion and some of those really hairy places that, you know, we were involved in during the Afghanistan conflict, or Operation Enduring Freedom was, I think, one of them. So it took me some places around the world which I never expected to visit. And I learned a lot about different industries as part of that.
Yeah.
Following that, I was promoted actually into G3's parent company, IAP, who were, I guess, the US equivalent. But again, operating the same sort of areas, And I spent time between Florida, the US and the Middle East, which was fantastic as a young lad.
Yeah, yeah.
Following that, you know, there was a restructure. I found myself wanting to look for a new opportunity, and I decided to harden my project management skills. So I joined an organization to work as a project manager for a short while, actually working on a data migration project for the Ministry of Defense.
Right. So you must have been DV cleared and all sorts then.
That's right, yeah. Secret cleared, actually. Yeah, I was secret cleared. I think we had list X status.
Oh, my God. That's the highest form of clearance. That's like a guy outside your house in a black suit watching you all the time, isn't it?
Well, that organization I joined, it, again, exposed me to many verticals. That was agency side. So, you know, I got into travel. I got into automotive. I got into financial services, all to do with customer data management and master data management. And I think ended up as operations director there. Before moving on into the not-for-profit sector with the RLI, and then of course with Amnesty International.
Yeah, sure. You seem to be fast-tracked into leadership roles quite early on, Paul. Would that be fair to say?
It was, yeah. When I worked for G3, they identified me on their what they called their specially selected staff development program, which was effectively their way of saying you could be a future director of this business.
Right.
And they invested very heavily in me to this day, which I'm super grateful for. Which included, you know, technical certifications with Microsoft, Cisco, all that good stuff, but also my master's degree, which was a super heavy investment for a young lad myself. I had some fantastic mentoring. They exposed me to things which were outside of my role as part of that program.
Yeah.
And I was very privileged.
So what lessons did you learn from the defense industry then?
I think the first and biggest is probably IT is not about tech. It's about people. You know, IT on its own can't do much. It needs people to engage with it. And IT exists to manage information. So what are you doing with the information? How are you using it? What's the benefit you're hoping to get from it? You know, what are the outcomes? So I think that whole piece was important to me. And I had to really tune in quite early on to my people skills, my soft skills, and how to influence, how to communicate, how to work cross country, cross culture, you know, how to work with people that had different priorities or maybe not the time to follow the 50-page process that someone had written. So I really had to tune into that early, and that was a bit of a shock to a young lad that, you know, spent all his time doing technical certifications. I hadn't done any people certifications at this point, so what was that? So I think that early on was important to me, but given some of the places I got to go, you know, working with other nationals, other country nationals where English wasn't the first language, it was a baptism of fire, but I'm grateful to it to this day because it put me onto a sure footing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's talk about 2017 then. The opportunity came up, if I'm not mistaken, in 2017, or maybe it was before that. You obviously got the role at RNLI, which is an organization I know very well, living on the coast, and an organization which I know is funded, it's like a charity, isn't it, through donations.
Yeah.
Is it 100% donations, Paul?
The odd grant here and there for specialist activity, but you're right, it's no government funding at all. It's specifically donations.
Yeah. So many people rely on them, don't they? And they do some amazing work and they save people's lives almost on a daily basis, don't they? It's incredible. Can you tell us about that period of joining RNLI and tell us a little bit about the organization?
Yeah, happy to. I mean, the RNLI, as you're right, you know, the UK and Ireland institution, they really are, you know, the best of what we do. And they're made up by so many brave people, you know, that will drop their Christmas dinner, drop their cup with their kid at a moment's notice to go out and hit the water at 3 o'clock in the morning in the dark for someone we don't know. That's the best of humankind right there. And I was inspired by that from the off. But you're right, you know, they've been around for a long time. I think they're approaching their 200-year anniversary soon. That came about, I think I was on a beach holiday with my wife, and you know, we saw the lifeguards and we saw the flags. And we just said to each other, wouldn't it be great to work for an organisation that had that kind of purpose, that had that kind of recognition? And kind of the rest was history. You know, I knew a few people that worked there, and an opportunity arose. And I managed to go through a competitive process to become the head of IT there, which is a big job, actually, at the RNLI. People don't realise, but the RNLI actually manufacture their own boats, design and manufacture their own boats. They run hotels, they run a college, they run shops, they run museums.
Do they?
They do. Wow. They've got logistical services, they've got the lifeguard service. There's a whole lot behind the scenes. And so working in IT gave you exposure to lots of other industries, again, manufacturing, retail. You get exposed to all these other interests as part of this. And I had a fantastic 5 years there working in a couple of different leadership roles.
I just remembered I've got a jar of jam in the fridge, which is RNLI branded. So, yeah, now it's hit me. They're everywhere, aren't they? Yeah. If you live on the coast, you've got RNLI something somewhere, haven't you? Eh?
Whole families, whole communities work with the RNLI, and it's phenomenal.
So what did you learn about culture working for RNLI then,
Paul? Oh, wow. I mean, RNLI, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, the epitome of leadership and courage. I think if you pick anyone up at the RNLI and cut them in half, they're like a stick of rock. They got RNLI right through them. And that courage, that leadership, that draw to the mission, that need to want to help runs through everyone in that organization. You know, everyone knows what they're there to do. There's no issue with translation between the objectives of the organization and what I do on a day-to-day basis. Everyone knows. As you say, it's steeped in history. So what did I learn about culture? I think people's willing contributions. I mean, you know, 40,000 volunteers at RNLI. 40,000.
Bloody hell.
People that give their time, their effort, their emotions for something that they don't get paid to do. Imagine going to the gym for half of your life, for 40 or 50 years of your life. That's what we're talking about here. People that would drop their day-to-day activity, their family, and go and do something. It takes a lot of things, doesn't it? So I learned a lot about, you know, the good of humankind at the RNLI. I'll be honest with you.
So what part does technology play in an organization like RNLI then? What was the purpose of your role, Paul?
Purpose of my role, the best way I can distill it down was to probably enable or multiply capability. So every role at the RNLI uses tech in some way, shape or form, or touches tech, as it does in most organizations now, to be fair. Everything, I mean, I gave an example of some of the kind of verticals that run through the RNLI with manufacturing and retail and customer relationship management, you know, in museums. And I think there were over 400 applications in that organization. So the technology landscape was vast. And the IT team had to know a little bit about everything in order to be relevant and to be able to add value and understand, be able to engage in a meaningful conversation with the customer. So I think it all became about data really quickly. We had a large team that had to be very savvy with data and start to really understand the difference that they could make through good data governance.
Did you always find then that you were sort of pushed on budgets then because it was a volunteer, obviously a charity and you're relying on donations. Were you on a sort of shoestring budget? And also, did you get a special treatment a little bit from vendors and things? Were they a little bit kind to you guys because you're obviously such a worthwhile cause?
Good question. I think any charity has budget constraints. Of course they do. They don't know when the next pound or euro is coming through the door. They can't guarantee it. You know, they're not in control of a product or a service, so to speak. It's goodwill. So there is always a challenge around value for money. Being able to show donors that you've spent that pound, that euro, wisely. We used to call it the red face test. You know, if I stood in front of Doris on the street corner who's rattling the bucket, could I promise her that 8 hours of stood there in the cold to gather that 25 quid would be in the right way? Could I look her in the eye and say that? That sticks in the back of your mind in day-to-day life in a not-for-profit. You know, so money for money, being able to show a difference really stands out. So you're always challenging what you've done. Even the decision you made yesterday, does it still stand today? You know, you can't be wedded to yesterday. So I think that's really important. In terms of the value for money piece with vendors, I mean, a lot of not-for-profits carry a lot of brand strength. You know, any organization wants to say they've got a for good aspect. This is where we help for good. This is where we're a responsible organization. So they like to be seen to work with charities and not-for-profits. Do we get preferential treatment? And in some cases, yes, there is not-for-profit or charity pricing. Probably a little bit more goodwill because like yourself, people know who you are, what you do, and there's a personal affinity. And the amount of vendors and account managers I've spoken to that have said, for example, my dad was fished out of the water by the RNLI, or, you know, something's happened, or my father was, you know, in terms of amnesty, he came from this country, and so I'm closer to that cause.
Yeah,
sure. You see that pop up more often than what you would expect, and that gives you an amount of goodwill, an amount of deeper understanding.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Looking back, where would you say the key milestones were for you and watershed moments that set you on this path that you went on? What sort of stands out for you as the key moments in your career? I know you did an MBA, for example.
I think becoming a young father at 19, as I said, changed my entire outlook on life because it wasn't about me anymore. It was about the life I could provide. But I had a very humble working class upbringing, which instilled a certain set of values in me and a certain approach to life and an approach to work and an approach to family. But certainly becoming a father, realizing that, you know, you get out what you put in, I think is probably something that's, I learned a little bit more later in life, and I got better with academia the more I did, I think, which is why I did a lot of distance learning, a lot of part-time learning sort of later on in life. Key milestones though, I think the MBA was transformational for me. I mean, I didn't, on its own, it doesn't get you jobs, but it gives you credibility with others outside of technology. It shows you're not just a pointy-headed tech person. You know, you get business.
Yeah.
You get business. You can have a conversation on their level about things that they understand. And it certainly helps you stand out from a crowd of equal peers. And so there was that, but I've learned more life lessons really, and it's difficult to point to one particular standout thing. But yeah. You get the odd moment where you think, do you know what? You feel like you've consolidated your experience, you've consolidated your lessons, and you feel like it's come together for a purpose. So getting the job at the RNLI was one example of that. Getting the job at Amnesty was probably another. You can see how you've got the job, given how you can draw things together. So, sorry, not a very specific answer, but hopefully useful.
No, that's great. What regrets do you have, Paul?
I wish I could have gone to full-time uni, to be honest, but we couldn't afford it when I was a kid. We couldn't afford it. I think I wish I'd realised earlier that probably the best investment you can make in life is in yourself.
Yes.
I think if I was to look back and talk to 18-year-old me, that would be the advice I'd be giving him.
You know, supposing you had a friend or maybe one of your daughters when they're a bit older, would you recommend doing an MBA then for someone who's ambitious in the business world? What would you say about someone who's coming to you for advice on whether to do an MBA?
It's not for everyone. I mean, at the end of the day, there's an academic career path. It's an academic qualification, isn't it? So you have to be comfortable with academia and learning and applying learnings in that fashion. If you didn't fit into the academia mold and you're someone that learns through the school of hard knocks, and you can still draw from the same experiences or have the same mentors, I think you can get a lot of the same sort of experience. If you were going to do it, I'd say be prepared to put the graft in, because you know nothing worth getting is easy. Certainly was graft for me for a good 3 or 4 years whilst working full time, giving up the weekends down the beach or the evenings in front of the TV watching films to go and sit at a table and write the latest paper or the latest dissertation. You've got to be prepared for that. But more importantly, you've got to be prepared for what it takes on your family. You've got to have a supportive wife. You have to have supportive kids that know dad's off doing that for a reason. Because there'll be times where actually you'll need them more than anything else. You'll need your wife to give you a G up or whoever your partner may be.
Early 2022 or maybe late 2021, you get the call. Amnesty International opportunity comes across your lap. Tell us about that period in your life.
Oh, it's a good story, actually. So I was actually introduced to the previous CIO through Mutual Connection. They were starting to look at some things that the Mutual Connection felt like I could help with. So we started to have a couple of calls, and sharing ideas, sharing insights, which is something I really enjoy doing as a CIO. And I think I put a post up yesterday on LinkedIn about something else I've done. So it started out as a friend conversation. How can I help? Have you thought about this? And that actually turned into a formal board advisor role for technology with Amnesty. So even before I joined, I was trying to help sitting on governance boards to offer external insights and be kind of a critical friend. When the opportunity arose, when the CIO role became vacant, I thought I'd throw my hat into the ring. You know, I felt I had some value I could offer. I felt like I could make a difference. And, you know, it's Amnesty. When human rights comes calling, you know, it's a great, great cause. And so I joined in February, actually, so about 6 months ago now.
Obviously, you joined at a tumultuous time. And I think, you know, a couple of months into your tenure, there was the Ukraine invasion. Amnesty have been heavily involved in that whole picture. What have you seen as the boots on the ground, Paul, in terms of Amnesty's involvement in Ukraine? Well, how has that impacted the organization?
Well, the first thing to remember is that the Ukraine type of situation, you know, these types of conflicts, they happen all time all over the world.
Yeah.
Some get airtime, some don't. Palestine and Gaza things have been going on for a while, right? And everything.
Yeah, Yemen as well. I mean, nobody talks about Yemen. That war was awful, wasn't it?
Absolutely. So things like that happen all the time. Some you hear about every now and again, some you don't. And so the Ukraine situation, I mean, clearly, as I said earlier, we're global. We had people on the ground there. So we had a corporate obligation to ensure our own people were safe. But then we had to mobilise into action as an organisation too, because that's what we do. You know, we look at where there's conflict. We try and understand it. We try and be impartial. And we try and report on it objectively for action. And that is harder than what it sounds, because as an organization, that means we have to be very good researchers. We have to draw on sources of primary, secondary, and tertiary information, you know, draw on knowledge that's already out there, interview people, you know, look at everything from satellite imagery to you know, photos of what's going on in a particular street. So that's what we do, though, all day, every day, all over the world. And so as an organization, it also, clearly, when you're producing reports that may not be favourable in certain corners, you have to understand that there may be backlash as well. But, you know, we exist because we have to challenge the status quo. We have to challenge what we're on in the world. And so as an organisation, that means you have to be quite resilient yourself too. Everything from your people to your processes to your technology. So whether it results in a personal attack to individuals of the organisation, whether it results in increased cyber risk to the organisation as a result. Because you have to remember, Amnesty, you know, at times can challenge governments, we can challenge large corporates. And so a not-for-profit that through physical action of producing a report can be at risk of virtual threat through the cyberspace.
Yeah.
We're state-level actors here, and we're a not-for-profit. You have to be on your guard, and it's very vast, and the landscape takes a bit of managing, but that's what we do. And that's how we've existed for the last 60 years, and that's what we continue to do.
Can I just dig into that a little bit,
sure.
The cyber threat? Because I know there may be, and I appreciate it, there's stuff you may not be able to elaborate on, but I think, have you been subject of cyber attacks then by states because of, you know, has anyone got a bone to pick with Amnesty then? Because you do expose a lot, don't you? You know.
Absolutely. I mean, the risk is always there, but I'd say it's probably more increased now. I mean, you know, we have very good partners, very good controls and measures in place. Of course we do. But at the end of the day, we're government level, you know, in terms of what we're talking to as well. I mean, and the threat is various. It could be anything from denial of service right the way through to shutting down the Amnesty website in a certain country so that country's population can't access it. And we have to think about how we react to that and what we do. So, yeah, I mean, every organisation is subject to cyber threat, I'm sure, but we have to particularly be on our guard, and we've got a good group of people that focus on that.
So, Paul, I know you're obviously very well-travelled, and, you've been to places like Afghanistan and stuff, so you're obviously quite streetwise in terms of the way the world works. What's really opened your eyes since you've been with Amnesty?
A specific examples would be hard to draw out, to be honest with you, Gareth, but I think that what has stood out for me is the sheer volume of stuff that's going on in the world that you just don't hear about every day, globally, and how many people it affects, directly or indirectly. You know, we have people that are working with us whose families are in some of these conflict areas who may have been subject to the conflict themselves. You know, so that really was the culture shock for me in joining Amnesty particularly, is that you tend not to hear about human rights issues in the news generally as Joe Public, unless something makes
it happen,
right? Unless it gets above the gas prices or above, you know, what happened with the football team on any given day. But it's day, every day. And that's why it's so important for an organisation like Amnesty and those like Amnesty to focus on this stuff, because it will go unnoticed, otherwise it will go unchecked. What really hit me also when I joined Amnesty, I mean, having been to places like Afghanistan, you know, as a civvie, I mean, I wasn't in the forces, but I saw the forces operate out there. I saw the lads and ladies coming back, you know, trying to do good, keep peace, trying to, you know, for all the good reasons they were out there, having spent days in the desert, suffering loss, suffering harm, you know, and I spent my fair share hiding in concrete bunkers because the base was under rocket attack, so to speak. So it brings all of those experiences really, really sharply into focus. And it allowed me to relate to what's going on and show some empathy.
Yeah. How sheltered do you think the British public are in terms of what's going on in the world then? Do we have no idea, or, you know, is it getting better, or?
You know, I'd be doing the British public a disservice if I didn't say they weren't an intelligent group of people, you know. I mean, and I've seen some of that. We haven't worked in Amnesty, but at the end of the day, the media controls a lot, don't they? Let's be honest.
Yeah.
I mean, no, you probably know yourself. You only hear about what they want you to hear about. And that's just life. You know, the media puts a spin on a certain aspect, a certain thing, and so on and so forth. And that's their job. But I think in terms of sheltered, I mean, the internet's a great thing, isn't it? You know, the ability to do our own research these days and to speak to peers and colleagues and friends and engage with complete and utter strangers about what's going on or topics of interest. In some of your answer to your question, probably a lot less sheltered than what we would be before the internet came along.
Yeah.
And you see that through the mobilisation of action, through the things that Amnesty does that we gather support for, through organisations like change.org that are able to gather, you know, tens and hundreds of thousands of signatures to things that you may not hear about in the news at all, through the power of social media, through the power of dedicated websites and other platforms. So I take a lot of encouragement from that, to be honest.
Do you know what, Paul? One thing that I've started doing recently, I've never been a news junkie, and I tend to try to stick to reading things which are going to improve me as a person, or at least, you know, be entertaining in some respect. But, you know, I'm not one of these people who has news updates on their phone and is completely on the pulse of things. I just think you'll end up going crazy. But I've started, in order to get a different perspective, I've tried to pull myself out of the Western media machine and tried to watch news reports from other countries, and like from India, WION in India, for example, or Al Jazeera is a good one as well. And it's brilliant to get, because all of these do English speaking, you know, it's an English speaking service. So, and it's brilliant for giving you a different perspective on events that are happening in the West, as opposed to the perspective of being in that bubble, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, so I definitely would recommend it. But I think it's important to take a global view on things, isn't it? So going back to Amnesty then, inevitably I was going to ask you about this, Paul, because it's your core responsibility, I suppose. But tell us about how technology helps Amnesty achieve its goals.
That's a great question. I mean, fundamentally, as I touched on earlier, we're a research and information-driven organization, right? The way we gather information, the way we assimilate it, the way we draw insight from it, the way we use it, and actually the way we archive that insight as well. Because, and let's not forget, a lot of Amnesty's work isn't just about the atrocity in today's language. It's about being able to tell the story over time. You know, this is a repeatable atrocity in this area against these people for the last 15 years, and here's all the evidence we've gathered over that period. There's a data lineage challenge as well, not just about the in the moment. So information is really core, and it cuts through everything that Amnesty does. I mean, it is the core value chain product. It's not like we produce cars or we produce boats or whatever. We produce information and insights and action. Sure. So technology has clearly got a huge role to play in that, and so has data governance. And so that's important. But also as a charity, you know, we, for the mission and to gather support, there needs to be a multiplier. And that, of course, is our marketing, our marcoms, our relationship with supporters. So the typical things you'll see around that, you know, some of the channels that we communicate through, like our websites, like some of the media that we produce, like the journeys that we take people on from being unaware to aware to a supporter or an advocate or a legator, you know, someone that can make a difference long after they're gone, whether that's a financial donation or a change in human rights law. And so the whole marketing, marcoms piece is really important to us too. So there's a particular technology challenge and data challenge around that as a multiplier effect. And then, of course, there's running the business, you know, there's running the organization, managing its people, managing its finances. So it's uncommon with a lot of other organizations, but information is really at the fore of Amnesty, which is a fantastic challenge for a CIO.
Yeah, no, of course. I've noticed on your website, Paul, it says that Amnesty International is a movement of more than 10 million people.
Yeah.
Well, that's incredible. So is that just in terms of people who have got an affiliation with Amnesty then, sort of like protesters and things, for example, in countries which are, you know, are suppressed or if there's a dictator in place or something like that? Is that who you're referring to there?
No, not at all. I mean, because, you know, for me, when I look at that number, it's a combination of those that support our activity, those that, you know, directly by putting signatures against petitions, or those that protest, or those that advocate, you know, reshare information, you know, fight for the cause in other ways, those that donate, those that come to us because they are at risk, to your point, and need help. They come to us for resources, for education, to be connected with others like them. You know, it's all those people. And there are lots of personas, I think, in that bucket in terms of how are you engaged with Amnesty. And of course, we've got volunteers too, those that give their time and intellect. So there's all of those people. And when you look at that number, you think, my word, well, that's also global. That's cutting across cultures and geographies and boundaries. It's a rich pot, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is. Keeping on the topic of the global picture, Paul, so I really love this one, okay? And I love some of the stuff you've talked about. I've been really, really enthralled with, to be honest with you. I love talking about stuff like this. But I wanted to get your view. Obviously, you've got a very global macro view on things, and you're in the tech world. So I wanted to ask you about global technology innovation in terms of human ingenuity and humans moving forward. And it can be across any sector, any walk of life. But what technology innovation are you most excited about in the world right now?
Oh, great question. I think so. At the times when I'm able to lift my head up and look at the horizon, you know, there's a couple of things that pique me at my interest. I mean, I guess specifically related to Amnesty, I am interested in blockchain. I don't know enough about it yet, really. I mean, I attend the webinars, I go to the roundtables, but I'm learning more about it because I'm particularly interested about how that can be used to enable immutable evidence management for Amnesty. So that thing was a valid interview. You know, no one's tampered with that interview, and it's immutable over time. I think that's quite relevant for Amnesty. But I've also been really interested in anything kind of Web3 or metaverse lately, because I mean, we've seen a lot of commercial actors and, you know, celebrities start to use it for NFT sales, you know, and virtual land and virtual yachts and all this kind of stuff. But I think in the not-for-profit space is exciting as well, because I think if you think about it, the ability to exercise your right to protest virtually, where physically you can't in a country for fear of getting arrested, I think that's quite powerful. The ability to be yourself or an alias of yourself somewhere else, so that you can be, you know, really truly talk about what is important to you and what you need help with. I think that's important. And there are a lot of applications for that. If you look across the not-for-profit sector, whatever your cause is, I think there's fundraising opportunity, clearly. You know, there's cryptocurrencies and all kinds of things that are going on at the moment, and virtual payments, all that sort of stuff. Opportunity for education, you know, it's a different medium, different planet, it's a different channel at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So I think for me, there's an opportunity for immersive experience in there. So imagine there's so many virtual reality headsets around these days. Imagine being able to put someone in a war zone, you know. Have you got one?
I bought it for my daughter, Paul.
Imagine being able to put someone in a virtual experience where they're in the middle of a war zone, you know, or where they're in the middle of the sea at night in the dark.
Sure.
You know, that's powerful, much more powerful than any written report will ever be, I think.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a lot of applications for it. And I think, I'm excited to see how that evolves.
Can you imagine, I got to put this to you, okay, you know, you think about it now, I mean, in terms of like, you know, global experts and things, we're only taking from a very small pool when you look at the human race as a whole, people who were born in countries or who have got the wealth to go through the education system and, you know, and become experts in medicine, in engineering, in rocket science or whatever. But can you imagine when we do nail this immersive learning thing and, you know, children who were born in the Congo or Paraguay are incredibly intelligent, but just are never going to have the opportunity to show that, you know what I mean? And all of a sudden, potentially they'll have access to world-class education. This is going to accelerate even more. I mean, you know, there's so much untapped talent out there. It's quite frightening, isn't it? And I think the technology you're talking about is potentially going to facilitate that.
It can. I mean, I think you have to remember, I mean, any technology has to be useful and usable. I mean, it's great that the technology is developing. It's great that it's moving along and it's providing all this fantastic capability. But if it's not accessible to these people, then you're missing out something, right? So as you said, you know, in other countries where perhaps there's not good internet, or perhaps where technology is harder to come by, or where perhaps the living wage is a lot lower. You know, that's the challenge. Yeah. The digital divide is the real challenge, because we've got technologies right here, right now today that would help a lot of people that currently can't access them. You know, we don't need any revolution on that. But the issue is the digital divide. Even in this country, you know, there is digital poverty in the UK because people can't have access to, you know, data, to connectivity, to devices at home. And that creates segregation. But, I mean, just to take one example, I think Gartner produced an insight that said that by 2027, they expect 1 billion of the poorest people on the planet to get internet access. So to your point, that's 1 billion people that can get benefit from technology, that maybe have to develop their top technology skills and work in technology. That's a big population, right? I mean, that would be another country if it stood alone. So the digital divide, I think, is as important as the development of stuff, and because that will produce technology, it will produce inspiration to inspire the next generation of technologists. And that's where I'd love to see us focus as a digital community, is on that digital divide.
Yeah, for sure. Just on the future thing, Paul, you know, obviously you came from a working class background, you mentioned. Obviously, you've been very successful, you know, as a CIO in a household brand name, you know, in Amnesty International, an incredible organization. What do you think about social mobility in the UK? Is it improving? You said you weren't able to go to university when you were younger. How is that going, do you think? Do you think that those circumstances are improving in the UK?
I can't give a clear answer to that. I mean, certainly be pockets of the UK where there's no social mobility, right? I mean, whether you're living out in the sticks or whether you're just in an area which suffers from poverty, I mean, it can be difficult to see a way out of that as an individual. But this for me is why the digital divide piece is so important, because you can digitally be where you physically can't. You can access things that you can't physically access. You can reach out to people, get education, get insight, get support. So I think that's really important. I mean, I was lucky in the sense that my parents saw the foresight to, you know, let's move away from the Midlands, let's go down the South Coast and have a different, you know, style of life. But I think there are multiple fronts to fight on, to be honest.
So this is one thing I had to ask you, Paul, okay? So you've got lots of hair. However, you've got you're a CIO and you've got 6 children. How the hell do you manage? So basically, where I'm going with this, Paul, tell us a little bit about Paul outside of work.
I try to be a family man as much as I can. I mean, we're all our harshest critics, aren't we? We can be better, but I try to be a family man. I started being a father when I was 19. You know, my eldest five kids are all 16 and above now, and I've got a little 3-year-old. I'm actually a grandfather as well, if you can believe it. I've got a 1-year-old grandson.
Oh, really? So you don't look old enough, Paul, and I'm not saying that to flatter you.
It's taken a big part of my life. So trying to be a good dad is important to me, as much as I can be. But outside of that, I touched on it earlier, and family influence and values and work ethic is something that's cut through me from a very early age. You know, my father's been a huge inspiration to me. But I think I live by the sea, so I enjoy sea kayaking when I can.
You into paddleboarding yet? That seems to be the craze now, doesn't it?
Paddleboarding is not for me. I spend more time in the water than on it, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I get that.
The wife and I have got a little 2-man kayak, and we go out together when we can. Really enjoy that. Weymouth's not really the tech hub of the world, so I find it hard to get to tech events in person, so the whole virtual thing has really helped me in terms of my development. But yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty busy guy between family and work, pretty busy guy.
So looking back at your career now, you touched upon this earlier on, but what advice would you give to your 21-year-old self, Paul? I suppose what I'm asking is, what would you have done differently?
I think I'd say the same thing. You know, the best investment you can make is in yourself. I think it will pay off. I had to work hard at school to be very average. It didn't come easy to me. You know, I was a B, C, sort of GCSE student. But the more I did, the more I got used to the academic system and how to answer questions in the structure that they would mark it. And I became better at it. I practiced it. But I think, I learned at an early age, I think, as I went on, that if you spend time learning, if you put in the time reading rather than watching the TV, not knowledge is, you know, you can't put a price on knowledge, can you?
No, absolutely.
And it served me well. So that is the single nugget I'd probably say to myself.
Yeah, sure. And another thing I like to ask people like yourself, because obviously your role is quite multifaceted and is quite complex in many respects. But when you get asked by, you know, a child, maybe your daughter when she was a bit younger, what do you say? What when they ask you, what do you do for a living, Daddy? Because CIO is not going to mean anything to them. So how do you describe your job to a child?
I've always struggled. I mean, my kids are just saying my dad works in IT or is in charge of IT. And that's the sum total of the conversation. Because it is quite a difficult thing to describe, isn't it? I mean, it's a chief what? I mean, what is an information officer? What's an officer? Yeah. It's hard to explain. So, but therein lies the problem, is that people do still, even adults, associate the CIO role with just being in charge of IT, you know, which is actually, it's much more about the application of I and T, information and technology, for benefit. Yeah. So it's much more about where the rubber hits the road. So I try and talk a little bit more about, yeah, we look after the techie stuff, but we try and move the needle for a business as well. Try and, you know, make more customers, save more money, make more money, you know, all those sorts of things. And I try and use tech to do that if I can.
Yeah. You help the organization using technology. Exactly. I think that's probably what you could say.
It has to be for a reason. So it's got to move the needle.
Yeah, move the needle. Yeah, for sure. So let's finish on this one, Paul. What book or story, documentary, if you want to use that as an alternative, what's inspired you over the last couple of years?
I'll be honest with you, Gary, I'm not a big book reader. It's always films and videos and computer games. I did read something recently. It's The Infinite Leader by Chris Lewis and Pippa Malmgren. I've started reading that the last couple of months. Still wading through it, but balancing the demands of modern business leadership. So I have a couple of books at the side of the desk which I'll try and dip into when I need a little bit of escapism. I mean, that one's my go-to book at the moment.
Okay, brilliant. We'll put that in the show notes, actually. And what else do you get up to then? Are you into sport or anything like that?
I love Formula One.
Oh, yeah.
Football at school, but when I realised I couldn't play it that well anymore, I lost a bit of interest.
Yeah.
I am a big fan of Formula One.
I'm not that surprised, because you were a wannabe pilot. You obviously like speed then, eh?
And actually, I think it's more accessible these days, the places they go to, and the education that comes along with the TV shows, explaining the technology, explaining the cars, explaining how data is used in telemetry. It's just fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. I've really enjoyed our conversation. We could have gone on for much longer, I'm sure, but I know you've got stuff to do. You've got lives to save. You've got to move the needle. But yeah, loads and loads of nuggets of value in there, which I'm sure will go down really well with our listeners. So thank you for coming on, and I wish you all the best with your future endeavors. Cheers, Paul.
Thanks, Gareth. Appreciate it.
So I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for downloading this episode. We really love doing this show and are absolutely humbled by all of the incredible people who download and listen, plus the incredible guests who take the time to come on and share their secrets and experiences with our listeners. Please can I ask that you take a couple of seconds to subscribe or follow the show. This small action means a lot to us and helps us greatly. Thank you. As you quite possibly have heard me mentioning in the past, we record the mass majority of our episodes at an amazing studio facility here in Cardiff at Tramshed Tech. Tramshed Tech is a collaborative community of entrepreneurs and scaling businesses geared towards supporting growth in tech, digital, and creative industries across an ever-increasing collection of locations and partner locations, UK-wide and internationally. It really is the perfect place for your business to start up, scale up, accelerate, or innovate. Head over to tramshedtech.co.uk or just search Tramshed Tech on your favorite social media platform.